Readings are taken from Luke chapter 21, verses 5 to 11, and Revelation 21, verses 1 to 7. Luke 21, 5 to 11. The destruction of the temple and signs of the end times. Some of his disciples were remarking about how the temple was adorned with beautiful stones and with gifts dedicated to God. But Jesus said, "As for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down." "Teacher," they asked, "when will these things happen, and what will be the sign that they are about to take place?" He replied, "Watch out that you are not deceived. For many will come in my name, claiming, 'I am he,' and 'the time is near.' Do not follow them. When you hear of wars and uprisings, do not be frightened. These things must happen first, but the end will not come right away." Then he said to them, "Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes, famines, and pestilences in various places, and fearful events and great signs from heaven." Revelation 21, 1 to 7. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things have passed away.' He who was seated on the throne said, 'I am making everything new.' Then he said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true.' He said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children."
For the last 4 years, since 2014 and the centenary of the beginning of the First World War, we have been paying particular attention to events of the First World War when we come to Remembrance Sunday every year. And when I saw in my diary and calendar that Armistice Day actually fell on the Sunday this year, I really felt that we simply couldn't just kind of have our 2 minute silence and then move on, as it were, because this being the centenary of the end of the First World War, it has to have some kind of comment. Having said that, I think the way in which the service has woven together already much of what I want to say, I think God has already been sowing in. The only trouble is you might not necessarily have picked it up yet. And so I'm just going to highlight some things. Occasionally you'll see photos like the one that's up here, which come from fairly frequently the men's trips that we go. Most Novembers we go over to France or Belgium and visit some of the memorial sites, or as in here, cemeteries associated with the First World War in particular. So I've got 3 points, and actually I'm being very Baptist, 3 points with alliteration actually, but that's just the way it worked today. The first one, obviously, has to be remember. Many of us are wearing poppies, which are a reminder to us that we are remembering those who have fallen. And here you will see memorials. Memorial means remember. Tim, in our act of remembrance, used that well-known phrase, we will remember them. We have an individual memorial here to a private from the Yorkshire Regiment. But down the bottom, we find ever remembered by his loving wife and daughter. A reminder to us that for every single one of those gravestones, there was a family left behind with their grief. That's where their memories were. And in many cases, like this person, a sweetheart or a wife, and indeed their children as well. There were individuals. There were battles. So in the middle, Passchendaele, one of the sites, it's a village where some of the most horrendous activities of the First World War took place, and one that we visited about 3 years ago, a memorial that was put up there by British veterans. And then in one of the museums, the memorial on the right, which is actually to everybody, to the glory of God and to the memory of 1 million dead of the British Empire who fell in the Great War, 1914-18. And you will tell already by the language of that, the period that it comes from, immediately after the war, no anticipation that there would be a Second World War at all within that, and still very much within an empire kind of theme as well. Remember, we will remember them. Remember some of the statistics. This is a picture of Croydon back in 1914, the troops being mobilised. 65 million. That is equivalent to the entire population of this country today. Every man, woman and child being in the army in the conflict. And when we think of the deaths, we don't always also remember those who came back with many, many injuries. A third of them were injured. We remember those for whom shell shock and the psychological impact of the war was first beginning to dawn on medical science. PTSD, as it's now called, post-traumatic stress disorder. On the screen you can see old photos of Cane Hill Hospital, as it was called in those days, the Cane Hill Asylum, where people suffering from shell shock, at least 26 Croydon men, were treated for it there. And on the right you see what's left of that asylum or hospital. Its water tower is the only sign of it now. There's a modern housing estate built around it. And we have to remember that practically nowhere was untouched. And even in this church community, 100 years ago, there was a grieving family. Lance Corporal Stanley Marshall died only a few months before the end of the war. His was a family that came from this church. On the screen, you see the cemetery where he is buried, and he represents one of the... Now, I've put up on the screen 8.5 million were killed during the war. But if you look more and more into it, you realise, you know what they say about statistics not being reliable and so on, because it depends, what do you mean by those who were killed? What do you mean by the war? What about the side conflicts, the conflicts that took place afterwards? What about those who were injured and then died a year or so later and so on? What about the civilians? And then you find these figures, you just can't, but somehow we have to remember that the numbers were huge and significant. So the easiest way to think about it very often is with those individual stories. The heroism. What I find fascinating is that at the end of the First World War, there were only two individuals who had received the VC, our highest decoration, twice. And both of them were medics. They weren't fighting soldiers. They were actually surgeon and doctor who went out into the most dangerous places under fire in order to rescue and to heal and help those who were wounded. At the top left, Arthur Martin Leake, a surgeon. He was at Zonnebeek near Passchendaele, I've just mentioned, and in fact the men's group next week will be very near to where that particular place was. They will be going to somewhere called Hill 60. Some of the worst fighting took place in that particular location. He had already won a VC in the Boer War and then won his VC, another one, in the First World War. And then you will forgive me if I had some real resonance with Noel and Christopher Chavas. Identical twins. One, a doctor. The other, a clergyman. Both having lived in Oxford, as both my brother and I have. And in fact, what I wanted to do in contrast here is Noel Chavas, and actually we have got a whole series, lots of these books. Please take one of these away with you to help you with this theme of remembrance, but also looking from a Christian point of view and Christian hope. Take one of these books, Silence, Remembering the World War. Because the story of Noel, I only realised when I picked it up this morning actually, the story of Noel is in this. So he was the one who was the medic and went right out into dangerous places, and he died in 1917 in the action in which he won his second VC. And as you can see on the screen there, he got his VCs at two of the worst battles, the Somme and the Passchendaele. But one of the reasons that I've put him up there and his brother is because Christopher survived the World War, as indeed did Arthur Martin Leake. And Christopher represents all the potential that was lost by the Noels who died. So when we see 8.5 million died, think of the waste of life and all that could have been achieved by the people who, if they had survived, then Noel might have done the kind of things that Christopher, his brother, did. So Christopher actually became the vicar or the rector of what is now a very famous Anglican church, and may well have been 100 years ago, St Aldate's in Oxford. It's an evangelical church. His father was a bishop, and he later himself became the Bishop of Rochester, and in between whiles he became Master of St Peter's College, Oxford. So an enormous amount achieved by one individual, but which was snuffed out in terms of what his twin brother could have achieved. The sheer horrific waste of war is one of the points I want to get across. And as you can see up there, there were over 600 VCs in World War I, five of which at Hill 60, which the men's group will be going to next week. But if we're remembering their heroism, do we not also need to be going further still? On many gravestones, you will find in the Commonwealth war graves, in the cemeteries there, underneath the name of a person who's died, here again an example from the Yorkshire Regiment, "Greater love hath no man." And they are quoting from John 15 and verse 13. "Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends." And whilst they are doing it in the sense of the camaraderie, in the sense of many of them were sacrificing for their nation, their king, for justice, for right, and so on, What we also always have to do when we're Christians is look at the context in which the actual verse comes. Greater love has no one than this, to lay one's down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends, says Jesus. I find it intriguing that we have an occasion like this where we remember with seriousness and solemnity the sacrifices of many people 100 years ago. And then we pay lip service to and pay scant attention to the death of the Son of God that has much higher relevance to every single one of us. Furthermore, not in any way wanting to diminish the importance of the sacrifice of those who died in order to keep our world free, nevertheless, to understand the significance of the death of Jesus. So as we think about the significance of the deaths of those who died in order that we might live freely, what about the one who died in order that we might have life and have it to abundance, who died in order to give us eternal life, who died in order to set us free from evil, who died in order to deal with my sin and your sin? Noel Chavas couldn't deal with my sin, great as his sacrifice was. But Jesus did. So we need to get these things in perspective. And we need to have that sense of, if we are have a sense of awe at the sheer figures of World War One, we should equally have as much awe of the love of God that he gave his Son for us. Have we got that within our hearts? Has it penetrated deep within us that Jesus calls us his friends and he laid down his life for us? Jesus laid down his life for you. Is it really there, locked away in your being and in your understanding? Okay, so we remember. In addition to we remember, we reflect. Very early on in the First World War, the very famous H.G. Wells wrote a book that described, it was a bit of a propaganda book or booklet, called The War That Will End War. And actually, we've got a video at the end of the service that kind of builds on that, but takes it in a different direction. And the general feeling was that this war was so big that at the end of it, that would be the end of war. That would be the end of killing and dying, because it would sort all the issues of the world that had been rumbling for the last century or two and that had kind of come up to this head rather like a boil. And the boil was being lanced by the First World War, and then the healing to the world would come. It was instigated by H.G. Wells, and then Woodrow Wilson, the President of America, was the one who then really popularized the statement itself. And H.G. Wells and Woodrow Wilson's sentiment was really the sentiment of the rest of the world as well. Because at the end of the war, so, you know, this day marks the end of World War One, and I'll make more of that in my next point as well. So the remembering is all that went on in the war, but we also mark the end of the war. And so at the end of the war, there was this sense that, right, that's it. The Great War, the only Great War, has taken place. You saw that memorial I put up earlier. There was no sense that there might ever be any other war. So there was this real sense of hope. And contrary to what the historians seem to imply about people's attitude towards God and church and faith immediately after First World War, in fact, the statistics tell us that people had that sense that God, out of his justice, had actually brought about the right conclusion. And those who had actually made war for unjust reasons had actually been conquered. There was a sense in which, because of so much, the battles were kind of knife-edge in terms of how they were decided, that God himself had been at work accomplishing the end of the war. So there was great gratitude and a real sense of God being in control at that particular stage. And so faith in God, attendance at church increased at that stage. And passages like that in Isaiah chapter 4 and verse 2, I'm going to look it up because it's only one verse, but it's quite a long verse, as many of Isaiah's verses are. Sorry, it's Isaiah 2 verse 4, not the other way around. He will judge between the nations. There was that sense that God had judged between the nations. And will settle disputes for many peoples. Followed by, and that's what the pictures are here, they will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And then nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war any more. That was the sense of hope that there was in the world in those days. And what came out of it was the League of Nations, to put all of that into effect. And unlike the United Nations, its successor, that seems to be sort of airy-fairy and spiritually all over the place, the League of Nations kind of had a strong Christian basis within its foundation. There you see a picture of the Palace of Nations in Geneva, now used by the United Nations, but was the headquarters of the League of Nations. So there was a new hope and a sense of a new world, using passages like Isaiah. But I've called this point reflect. And why do I call it reflect? Well, I'm going to tell you, Alan, all right? Because not only have you got to look at Isaiah, but you've then got to go for passages like the first passage that Janice read to us, and that is to Luke 21. I'm going to lose my voice, so I need to take some water. You can have some a bit later, Alan, all right? In that passage, Jesus is talking about the future destruction of Jerusalem, but he's also talking about the end times, and he's also talking about the suffering of the church. And sometimes it's really difficult to work out which bit applies to what where, and this is not a sermon about the end times per se. But there are aspects of that that we want to look at. And one of the things we need to realize when we look at historic events like the First World War and then the Second World War and where we are at the moment is we are in the in-between times. So Jesus, our hero, has conquered death, but death is not completely conquered and will not be yet. Jesus has won the victory over evil. And we believe that the right victors won in the First World War and most certainly the Second World War with all the horrors of Nazism. But Jesus warns us, and this is where we have to reflect. This is where Christians have to be wise instead of naive suckers. When you hear of wars and uprisings, and there will be wars, not if, but when, says Jesus. And there have been, as many, many people have said, more wars in the last century since the end of what they thought was the last war, the war to end all wars. There have been more wars than really in the centuries before. There have certainly been more casualties, more deaths than ever in human history. Most especially civilian deaths. Prior to that, civilian deaths were few and far between, generally speaking. They'd be horrific in terms. But Jesus has warned. So when we look at our world and it gets us down, the whole point of Jesus in Luke 21 of telling us is he's, look, I know it's going to happen. I'm forewarning you. It's part of the battle between Christ and Satan. It's part of the battle between good and evil. It is part of the birth pangs before the final victory. But don't be deceived. That's what Jesus says in verse 8. Don't be deceived. And how easily we are deceived, which is why he's warning us not to be deceived. And that's why the League of Nations did not work, because the politicians and the nations, in their rather naive hope that this would be the war to end all wars, didn't see Nazism coming. And as I put up on the screen, didn't recognize that the punitive sanctions after the Treaty of Versailles that were applied to Germany led to a resentment and a restlessness that made National Socialism, Nazism, favorable in the country and a factor in the rise of the Third Reich. Incidentally, some of the boundary changes in other nations in the Middle East continue to be a running sore as a result of what went on in the First World War. Don't be deceived. But what Jesus also says is be prepared. And in verse 21, he talks about getting out, running away and escaping. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the city get out, and let those in the country not enter the city. That was specific to the destruction of Jerusalem, but the principle is there. For heaven's sake, don't stay in danger if you don't need to. There will be occasions when you need to get out. And how true that has been for the Christian church under persecution in some of the worst parts of the world. But because we're relating things to recent wars, I've put up there the Kinder Transport. That is a statue or group of statues that's at Liverpool Street Station, not far away. 10,000 children from Germany, Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, a number of other places were brought into this country to get them away from the clutches of the Germans, largely Jewish children, but not all of them, in just 9 months in 1939. The hospitality of this country. Oh, that the people, sorry, I'm being political, who said we need to get out of Europe. Sorry, shouldn't talk about Brexit from the church, should we? Only knew the hospitality, or the history, the heart of Christ, that actually spoke out. Don't you think when those 10,000 children were brought to this country, God was going, hallelujah! Our country is not ours to say, you stay out. Our country is God's. And if he has welcomed us, we should welcome others. And I guess I've moved on to the second point there, haven't I? Sometimes speak out as well. Because there are times when Jesus actually says it's not just a case of get out and get out of the way of danger, but also speak. Do not worry what you are to say in verse 14, but actually make up your mind not to worry, or try and plan what you're going to say or how you're going to defend yourself. For I will give you words and wisdom that none of your adversaries will be able to resist or contradict. Look at those two there. Of course, I can stand here smug because neither of them is our government leader. Well, one or two exceptions. Are they world leaders who are offering hospitality in the way that those 10,000 children were? Are they world leaders who are bringing the peace that Karen and Tim were praying about earlier? Or are they simply those who are interested in self-aggrandizement, power? Frankly, they're bullies. That's what Jesus means when he says, reflect and don't be deceived. Far be it from me as an Englishman to tell an American how to vote. But for us, actually, the other aspect of it, let's kind of avoid the political side of it, but there is a readiness that we should always have to talk, as Peter says, is a lovely, lovely verse. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope you have. Have you ever had somebody say, why are you Christian? Why do you go to church? Why do you behave in that way? And you feel all of a sudden tongue-tied. You don't quite know what to say. Well, Peter's saying, be ready. Pray about it beforehand. Slightly contradictory to the bit in Luke 21, isn't it? Which is, don't worry what you're going to say. But I guess what Jesus is really saying is, have in your heart that sense of who you are, your identity, your sense of knowing what the gospel is all about, your sense of hope, so that actually if anyone says, it comes out. But you don't have to have planned it as kind of, this is my testimony and I'm going to do it in a very controlled wooden way, which is what Peter is going on here. But do you realise we are God's mouthpiece, every single one of us, wherever we go, in our block of flats, in our street, in the place where we work, in the community amongst which we mix, where our children go to school. We can be God's mouthpiece to other people. That's all he's asking. Be prepared. Be prepared to speak out and to speak out truth. That's what these guys need to hear, truth. But the final thing, the final point I want to get to, need to finish quickly. One of the things that dawned on me this week as I was preparing for this message is that unlike so many other remembrance occasions and remembrance services, this is the day we mark the end of the war. And so what do you think that means in terms of how people 100 years ago today were feeling? Or put it another way, how do you think they were feeling yesterday when the war wasn't over compared to how they were feeling today when they knew the war had finished? Well, Siegfried Sassoon, who was became a famous World War I poet, this is what he wrote. Everyone suddenly burst out singing. And I was filled with such delight as prisoned birds must find in freedom, winging wildly across the white orchards and dark green fields, on and out of sight. Everyone's voice was suddenly lifted, and beauty came like the setting sun. My heart was shaken with tears, and horror drifted away. Oh, but everyone was a bird, and the song was wordless. The singing will never be done. That sense of joy, that sense of relief. And the Evening Standard that picked up on this, we went into London on Friday, picked up an Evening Standard. There was an Oxford historian academic who wrote an article for the Standard. And this guy was picking up on the sense of joy and release and quoted a New Zealander who'd been fighting but was back in this country recovering from his wounds. And he said, this New Zealander, that London party for 3 days. The party has just begun, is really what the 11th of November 1918 was all about. It was the joy of having survived. Another little comment. They brought the piano out into the street so that everybody could play and dance around it. And so on. The crowds that were in Trafalgar Square, I saw an article on the BBC. If you go into Parliament Square and at the bottom of Nelson's Column, you will see there is some damage to the stones. Someone lit a fire that was some of the old placards to do with the war that were no longer needed and burnt all of these placards. It was part of, you know, the euphoria and the joy and so on. But the result was it damaged some of the stones on Nelson's Column. There is the evidence of the euphoria and the joy of the occasion. the joy of victory, which is a joy that we have in Jesus because he has won the victory over death. The joy of no more killing. The joy of normality. And as I said, the joy, at least the hope at that stage, of a new order. New nations emerged. You have to have a map, don't you? Have to have at least one map in one of my sermons. But see the change to the boundaries. Okay, joy for the people who were newly set free, like the Czechoslovaks or the southern Slavs. That's what Yugoslavia means, the southern Slavs. And of course, we see those countries broken up even more nowadays. But there was a lot of conflict post-war. That's why I said you can't tell all the deaths and so on. But at that stage, there was the joy and the hope of new nationhood. But especially, and so this other passage that I brought out, Revelation 21, no more death. No more killing means no more death. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. The day before, however small the risk as the war was coming to an end, nevertheless, there was still a risk of dying. Mrs. May, Theresa May, laid a wreath this week at the grave of what is likely to have been the last British soldier killed 90 minutes before the armistice, died on the day of armistice. So death was still a threat. And death is still a threat to all of us. We've all had loved ones, dear ones who have died, some of us very recently. We all of us, unless Jesus comes soon, have got to face death. And some of us face that somewhat stoically. And we think, well, I've got a Christian faith and therefore that's going to be fine. But none of us know what it's going to be like. We've all got to go there. Some of us are very anxious about it. But Jesus tells us clearly here, there will be that stage when there will be no more death, no more mourning, no more crying, no more pain, and every tear will be wiped away from our... This is our Christian message. So when, with Peter, someone asked you to give the reason for the hope that you have, this is the hope that we have. We have hope for life. We have hope for eternity. But that gives us a quality of life and a poise that enables us to live today and speak into today. And counter the bullies and so on. So no more death, but life. The sun rising over the poppy fields. The idea of the victory of God in the resurrection of Jesus that is certainly ours. And then Tim, didn't he? Did you pick up the allusions to Romans 8 in what he was praying immediately after the remembrance? Thank him, won't you, Heidi? That sense that you've also got in Revelation 21 of the renewal of creation, of everything. I saw a new heaven and a new earth. I am making everything new. And just to confirm it, to tell us he is the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega. Do you have that hope? Do you have that hope in Jesus? Walking down the street, knowing about the trouble we have in our borough with knife crime. Do you have that hope if you travel abroad, knowing the risks of terrorism? Do you have that hope facing illness or looking after relatives? Do you have that hope in Jesus? Again, that hope was alluded to in one of our hymns, and actually it was based on Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 19. We have this hope as a sure and certain or steadfast anchor for the soul. I was a member of the Boys Brigade in my youth, and I think there was a BB company here years ago. That was the motto. That is the motto of the Boys Brigade. We have this hope as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul. In your life, have you got that anchor in God that enables you to live a life that is safe, because whatever's going on, you're anchored in Jesus? That's what the Christian message and the Christian hope is. So remember the sacrifice. Reflect realistically on the state of the world. but rejoice in our certain hope.